We'll be speaking about recent works we did with Al Shapir connecting quantum error correction codes to conformal field theories. So here's the plan of the talk. It consists of three parts. First part is the main part, and it's pedagogical, and it is not about quantum codes, but about classical codes. In fact, this part is about some relatively old story, which was, I think, mostly understood in late 80s, maybe early 90s. Somehow it was not in the focus of attention by the community, and therefore many people, especially young people, probably don't know about this story. But this story is about the connection between classical error correction codes, Euclidean lattices, and chiral conformal field theories. So this part about the relation between codes and lattices is a well-known topic in discrete mathematics. There is no physics, there is no part of it which is related to physics. Well, I should not say it like that. I should say simply that this is a well-defined, well-understood topic within discrete mathematics. And then once you have Euclidean lattices, especially even so dual ones, you can connect them to chiral CFTs. Okay, we did not contribute to the story, but I want to speak about it anyway, because if I explain the story, if we understand the story well, then it will be completely clear what we did here. What we did, we connected quantum codes, which are quantum analogs of the classical codes, but instead of connecting them to Euclidean lattices, we connected them to Lorentzian lattices, and those in turn can be related to non-chiral Norian CFTs. Once we understand this part, which is the main contribution of our paper, or I would say of our two papers, then we can discuss some applications. Those applications would include conformal bootstrap, holographic correspondence, some nice examples of theories with extended symmetries, and so on and so forth. Okay, so let me start with discussing what is a code. Now, if you do coding theory, or if you know what codes are, nothing which I will say will be new or even interesting to you. This presentation assumes that you have no prior exposure to codes at all. So a code is a rule to take messages you want to send to someone over noisy channel. And when I say noisy channel, it sounds like a specific term, but you can think about everyday example. When you try to say something over a noisy phone line, when you have bad connection, like sometimes happens these days with Zoom. So you try to transfer some information. And instead of transferring this information in plain English, instead of saying words like letter by letter, you instead try to submit each letter separately, and you encode each letter in a way of a code word. So the simplest example of that is what is called phonetic alphabet, when each letter of English alphabet can be associated a word. So A would be apple, and B would be bravo, and many other words up to Z. I don't know what Z is. I don't remember what the code word for Z is, but basically each letter corresponds to a code word. And instead of saying letters, you say the whole code words, and those code words are chosen to be very distinctively sound very distinctively from each other. And therefore, if you hear apple, there is no mistake, the corresponding message was A. If you hear bravo, there is no mistake, the corresponding message was B. If you have two words which sound similar to each other, then there could be confusion, a mistake. But that's why you try to choose words which sound as distinctive from each other as possible. Okay, so this is an everyday example of a code, a real one, but we want to formalize this a little bit, and we want to say that each message will be encoded in a binary string. So instead of saying apple or bravo, we will send binary strings, that's fine. Binary strings, by the way, appear in the Morse code and other everyday, another real life example of a code. So each code, each message will be assigned a code word, which is a binary string. And we will also require that all strings have the same length. In the Morse code, different code words have different lengths, but I want to say that in my abstract binary code, all code words have exactly the same length, which is n. Okay, so a quantum code is a collection of k binary strings, and those binary strings are called code words. So K is just the number of those binary strings, and the code is denoted by this letter C, which stands for Latin letter, which stands for code. So code words are just binary vectors. Right, and the code is a collection of those vectors. Okay, if this is more or less clear, then so what I said so far is that a code is characterized by three numbers. It's not a unique characteristic, but these are basic characteristics of a code. How big n, how big the string is, each string, how many strings you have, that's k, and d is a characteristic of how distinct those strings, how distinct those strings are from each other. I have not defined d yet, but I will define it in a second. There is a nice geometric way to think about codes. You can say that a binary string parameterizes a vertex on a unit cube, right? Unit cube has vertices, each coordinate is either zero or one, and therefore each code word is essentially coordinate parameterization of a vertex on a unit cube. And therefore binary code is a collection of points on an n-dimensional cube. For example, on this picture, I have three-dimensional cube, and I highlighted two points with this blue, this and this. I highlighted those two points. Okay, so now I want to define what is the distinguishability of two code words. I will say that code word C1 and code word C2 are different from each other. The distance between them is the number of bits I need to flip to turn one code word into each other. And if you visualize code words as vertices on a unit cube, then you can easily understand that the distance between two code words is the same as the distance between those two vertices calculated with the ANT metric. Ant metric is the distance an ant, an animal, needs to walk along edges from one vertex to another. Okay, so in this example, of course, you can choose different paths, but we are talking about the minimal distance. In this case, the distance between those two highlighted points is 3, which means that the distance between two points 0, 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1 is 3. Which is to say that you need to flip all three bits to turn one string into another. Of course, geometrically, you can say that this distance is the same as the length squared between those two points, where length is calculated with the conventional Euclidean metric. So this distance, which is n distance, is the same as Euclidean distance. Okay, now a code is a collection of code words. It's a collection of points on the cube. And to characterize a code, we need to find the weakest spot. The weakest spot is a pair of code words which are maximally close to each other. So you scroll through all n multiplied by n minus 1 over 2 pairs. So there is n multiplied by n minus 1 over 2 pairs of code words. You calculate distance between each pair and you choose the minimal one. The minimal one characterizes the code at its weakest place. That's its weakest link, if you wish. And that characteristic is called the Hamming distance of a code. Okay, so we defined n, we defined k, and we finally defined d as the minimal distance among all pairs of code words. And here you have the distance between C1 and C2. notations on use d here on the left and on the right. On the right, this is just the distance function. On the left, that's Hamming distance of the whole code. Okay, now, nothing what I said is complicated, but I wanted to explain the situation very clearly, and I also want you to have some intuition on what it means to design a good code. To design a good code means that you fix the number of dimensions n, so that's assumed to be given, and then you try to label or choose as many vertices on a unit cube in n dimensions as possible, while keeping the minimal distance between any pair of points as large as possible. Now, there is obviously tension, there is obviously contradiction. More points you choose on unit cube, smaller distance between points will be. So the art of designing a good code is either trying to maximize number of points while keeping the minimal distance between them fixed, or maximizing the distance between them while keeping the a number of chosen points fixed. Okay, so that's the job of finding a good code. Despite an elementary formulation of what code is, and rather simple formulation of what a good, well, essentially nothing is known. Very little is known about codes when dimension n is large. For example, there are bounds on how effectively you can choose points while keeping distance, minimal distance between those points. Or rather, if you choose certain fraction of points, let's say instead of like you have n, that's number of dimensions, then you have log k with base 2. And usually you keep, it will be clear in a minute why, usually you keep this ratio fixed and you take n to infinity. So you're saying which kind of fraction of points on a unit cube you want to occupy, you want to highlight and make them parts of your code. And with this number being fixed, you try to maximize D. So it's not known what's the best possible D in that case. Well, the right quantity is D divided by N, but the value, the asymptotic value of this quantity is not known. And furthermore, we actually essentially don't know how to design codes where D will scale linearly with N. We know that if you choose a random combination of points, then with a very large probability, D will be scaling linearly with N. That we know. But how to design it and make sure that what you designed has D proportional to N, we do not know. So basically, we do not know how to answer even most elementary questions. Okay, so this is about codes. This is about binary codes. Now I want to introduce a notion of a linear code. What is a linear code? A linear code, when you say, you know what, I will choose my code words, I will choose my vertices on a unit cube in the following way, I will define linear function, which will depend on some auxiliary binary variables x. When I say that variables are binary, it means that all algebra here is done modulus 2, or in a mathematical language, this is an algebra over Galois field with two elements, which is the same as a two elements 0 and 1 with a conventional algebra between numbers 0 and 1. So if you are not familiar, not readily trained in this business of fields besides R and C, then just forget about this language of algebra over discrete field GF2. Just think about doing conventional algebra and then taking modulus 2 in the end of the story. So we have the following naive ansatz. I will define my code words by introducing some auxiliary matrix G and some auxiliary variables X, and just exhausting all possible values of the function G multiplied by X. There will be 2 to the small k values. So there will be capital K equal 2 to the small k of code words. Okay? Now, if I do that, this would be a linear code, and linear code satisfies the following property. If C1 and C2 belong to a code, then C1 plus C2 also belong to a code. So basically, a linear binary code, not general binary code, but linear binary code, is a vector space in n dimensions. It's in n dimensions. It's a vector space over this Galois field 2. It's a discrete vector space. It would have certain number of generators, basis vectors, and all other vectors can be obtained as linear combinations, but linear combinations will only have integer coefficients equal 0 or 1. So any code word can be defined as x1 c1 plus blah, 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 plus xk ck, where this is this k. And that's it. That's the most general code word you can have. Obviously, there will be 2 to the k code words. And of course, everywhere here, you need to divide by mod 2, and x is either 0 or 1. Each x is either 0 or 1. So this is what linear code is. Now, you might think that choosing linear function is a bad idea, because then your code points might be living on a certain codimension or coplane or hyperplane. So it would be a bad design of your code, but this is not true. Yeah. Linear codes are as effective as any other codes. I hesitate to give you a mathematical statement of that, but there is no known mathematical result, at least not to me, at least not in the standard textbooks, meaning not in a general context, that linear codes are disadvantaged in any particular way. Okay, so linear codes is not a bad choice. It's certainly a simple choice when it comes to algebra. Okay, I only covered one slide. It's the most important slide though. If we are good with definition of codes, what classical code is, everything else will be more or less straightforward. So I will pause here after just first slide and ask you if you have any questions. I want this to be really crystal clear. So if you have any confusion, please ask me. Okay. I hope this is crystal clear. Now, the rest is technicalities. Now, a code, by the way, a linear code has, well, this formula, k, capital K equal 2 to the k code words. And instead of writing n capital K d, we usually write k n small k d. People usually write small k without telling this is a small k, but you can easily understand that from the context. Obviously, small k is smaller than n. And the problem is, while keeping k divided by n fixed, maximize d over n, something like that. Okay, so now if you have linear code, it's very easy to see that you can choose vector x. You can choose vector x over here to be zero vector, which means that you will have c equals 0, which means that origin of your cube is always a code word. So what is shown here on the picture is actually a linear code. It consists of two vectors 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. And that basically means that your generator matrix, G is called generator matrix, is a 3 by 1 matrix, which consists of three. So the example here is an example of a linear code, which is denoted as 3, 1, 3. N equals 3, K equals 1, and D equals 3. Okay, now if you care about Hamming distance between pairs of code words, it's clear that the distance doesn't change under parallel transport. D C1 C2 is equal to D C1 plus C prime, C2 plus C prime, where C prime has to be a proper code word as well. And therefore you can always choose C prime to be equal to C1. And since we are working modulo 2, C1 plus C1 is equal to C1 minus C1 is equal to 0. So basically, this can always be represented as a distance between origin and some code word in your code. Okay, so Hamming distance for the linear code is the minimal distance your code word comes to the origin. Now, if you want to be mathematically rigorous, you need to remember that origin itself is a proper code word. So when you say this phrase, you should say, Hamming distance is the minimal distance a proper code word which is non-trivial comes to the origin. Okay, now if I consider conic, if I consider spheres which originate from the origin and increase sphere and increase radius of the sphere, I may want to know how many code words belong to a sphere of a particular size. That information is called the spectrum of the code. How many, it's basically how many points like this situated at a certain distance away from the origin I have. So there is a convenient vehicle to encode this information. There is a convenient vehicle to store this information in the form of the polynomials, in the form of a polynomial. Obviously, an information, the spectrum of the code, it's a table of numbers. Let's say distance zero away from the origin, I have only code word which is trivial. Distance one from the origin, let's say I have zero code words. Distance two from the origin, let's say I have three code words, and so on. So, so I have a table. This is the definition. I sum over all code words. I introduce two auxiliary variables, x and y, such that the polynomial is homogeneous. So strictly speaking, only one of these variables is non-trivial. And this one variable, what it does, it keeps track, it organizes information about spectrum. It keeps track about this omega of c. Omega of c is what is called the weight. This is the distance away from the origin. Okay? So this polynomial, you can ask why I want to represent this information in the form of the polynomial, why I don't want to represent it in some other way. That's because this polynomial has nice symmetries depending on properties of your code. For example, it could be that if you start going away from the origin, there will be no points located odd distance away from the origin. You will notice that c squared is always even. If this is the case, then your code is called even. Sometimes it could happen that c squared is actually divisible by 4. In this case, the code is called double. In this case, the code is called double even. If your code is even, the following is trivially true: x y is equal to w of x minus y. That's because this w is always divisible by 2, and therefore y is either in a second power or fourth power, and so on and so forth. If your code is double even, it means that the following is satisfied. So this algebraic identities keep information about code, and it's much easier to write things like that just to say than just to say that each coefficient is divisible by 4 or something like, oh, sorry, than to say that only coefficients associated with weights divisible by 4 are non-zero. There is another similar identity, very important one, which is called Mach-Williams identity, and it tells you the following. If you take a code, it's a linear space over binary field of 0 and 2. Since it's a vector space and there is a scalar product, the conventional one, pretty much, C1, C2, it's a conventional scalar product. You just need to multiply, you just need to calculate mod 2 here. It's a conventional, pretty much conventional scalar product. It has all the, it satisfies all the axioms of a scalar product. Then for any vector space, you can define dual vector space. And dual vector space is of course binary vector space, so it's also code. So for any code, we can define a dual code by defining a dual vector space. Now, it happens sometimes that the space itself is dual to itself. In this case, the code is called self-dual. And if the code is self-dual, its enumerated polynomial satisfies this non-trivial identity. That can be proven using a version of discrete Fourier transform. I will not do it now. I don't think it's very intuitive. You need to calculate something, but it's very important. Please trust me on this. We will not derive this, but it's very important that if the code is self-dual, we have this algebraic identity. Together as, let's say, this algebraic identity, which comes from other properties like double evenness of the code. Okay, these are technicalities. Let's move on. Let's go to the next chapter. I want to associate a lattice to a code. And to associate a lattice to a code is not very difficult. I consider first a cubic lattice, and then I take a unit cube from the origin, and I highlight all the vertices according to the rule we discussed before. So I take a code and I choose certain vertices in the unit cube. And then I take this cube and I do parallel transform of this cube in all directions in a checkerboard way. In a checkerboard way means that I don't move it one step away. If I moved it one step away, then this point will be highlighted and this point would be highlighted. You probably do not see that like this. If I move this unit cube one step away, then this point will be highlighted and this point will be highlighted. I don't want to do that. I don't want to highlight those points. I specifically move things two steps away, to the right, two steps away in all possible directions in the checkerboard way. And mathematically, it means the following. Let's consider a vector v, which is integer valued. V1, vn, all of these are integer variables. I calculate v mod 2. If I do that, I obtain a binary string, which consists of n zeros or ones. And then if this binary string is a proper code word, then I highlight corresponding point with this original coordinates. And if it's not a proper code word, I don't highlight it. After I do that for all points on your cubic lattice, you obtain a periodic structure on a cubic lattice, like I tried to show here with this point, this point, this point, this point. And of course, you need to expand that in all possible directions. And this periodic structure is actually a lattice itself. Mathematically, it's a lattice according to mathematical definition. And this lattice is called construction A lattice of a code. Now, there is one important subtlety here. Mathematically, besides taking this definition, we also try to rescale things by square root of 2. To rescale by square root of 2, I need to define this periodic structure in a cubic lattice, and then I need to squeeze things by square root of 2. So I'm trying to squeeze, you should see that on your screen. Of course, if you had a lattice and you squeeze it by square root of 2, it remains to be a lattice. I'm returning the size of my window to the previous size, the original size. It has nothing to do with the lattice, I just want to restore the original size of the presentation. Okay, why do we rescale by square root of 2? We rescale by square root of 2 because of the following important property. If your code was self-dual and you define lattice this way and did bother to rescale by square root of 2, if your code was self-dual, your lattice will be self-dual. That's not difficult to prove. And for this proof, rescaling by square root of 2 is absolutely important. And of course, self-dual lattice is very special. And therefore, we want to have self-dual lattices. And for that, we adopt this definition. Once you have this definition with a square root of 2, then you can say the following. If your lattice was even, it means that each vector in your lattice, each vector x belonging to your lattice, will have modulus squared, which is an integer number. That's okay, but that's nothing special. But if your lattice, if your code was double even, it means that x squared will be integer number multiplied by 2, which means that double even code will correspond to even lattice. Okay? Those two things are independent. You can have double even code, which is not self-dual, then you will have even lattice, which is not self-dual. You can have self-dual code, which is not double even, then you will have self-dual lattice, which is not even. But nicely, you can have both. You can have double even code, which is also self-dual, then you will have self-dual lattice, which is also even.
Sorry, Anatoly, could I just ask a question?
Yeah.
So what exactly does a self-dual lattice mean here in this mathematical context?
Yeah, sorry. I explain things in such a careful detail about codes because that's not what string theorists usually study. I mean, depends on a person, but as a let's say generalized curriculum, but I assume that lattices are more familiar. That's probably true for some people, but I made a mistake of not even defining what lattice is. Basically, lattice is like a discrete version of vector space. You have in n-dimensional space, you have n vectors. And the lattice is a collection of points, a1, e1, plus blah, 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 an, en, where all numbers ai are integer numbers. So it's like discrete version of your vector space. Now, a lattice is called even if any vector x, which belongs to your lattice, has a length squared, which is an even number. So it first of all has to be an integer number. From this definition, it doesn't follow that it will be an integer number, and it doesn't have to be an integer number, right? But there's a special class of lattices for which x squared is an integer number. This is not what is called integer lattice, by the way. This is not. But I will explain what integer lattice is in a second. But if x squared is an even number for any x, then the lattice is called even. What is a dual lattice? Dual lattice is a collection of points y such that y scalar product with x for any x from your original lattice is an integer number. Okay, so it's like a dual space in a sense. It's a space of all vectors in your whatever dimensional space such that the scalar product with all lattice points, original lattice points, is integer. It can be shown that this redefined lambda star as a set. We can actually show that it is a lattice itself. Lattice is called, it's called dual lattice. Lattice is called self-dual if as sets they coincide. Integer lattice is such a lattice that it is a sublattice of its dual one, which means that for any x and y belonging to the lattice, their scalar product is integer. Now, if lattice is even, it is automatically integer. If lattice is integer, it is not necessarily even. So we are working with a lattice which is even. Oh, sorry, that's not what I wanted. We are working with a lattice which is even, which means that it is automatically integer. Scalar product of any two vectors will be integer. But in fact, we are working with a self-dual lattice. If for any x, if y is such that for any x, xy is integer, it means that it actually, y actually belongs to the same lattice as well. Does it help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so when you have a lattice, any lattice, you can define what is called theta series, or I call it a theta function. I think mathematicians call it theta series of a lattice. You introduce holomorphic variable Q and you sum over all lattice vectors V. V is not this V, this is actually, V is actually an element of a lattice, so it's already rescaled. And then you additionally rescale it by square root of two according to this formula. That's just notations. That's how people define things usually. And for each lattice vector, you have this quantity Q to some power. If your lattice is integer, then Q will be taken to integer power. It doesn't have to be the case. Then in this case, you will have a series where Q is taken to some complicated power. But if you have even lattice, which means that it's also integer, V squared over two will be an integer number. So it will have some Taylor series, convergent or divergent. It's actually convergent and you can show that. And this function theta has nice modular properties. In particular, if your lattice is even self-dual, this is actually a modular form. Theta is a modular form. For construction A lattices, you can immediately calculate theta series by plugging Jacobi theta functions inside a numerator polynomial. So that's the beauty and power of a numerator polynomial, that instead of calculating this infinite series, you can just plug two Jacobi theta functions inside the polynomial, and here we go. Okay, now at this point, what happens is you want to know how happens that this is a holomorphic theta function. For this to be a holomorphic theta function, it should change nicely under two transformations which generate SL to Z, or maybe PSL to Z group. There are two generators, You shift tau by one and you invert tau into minus one over tau. And apparently covariance of theta series under this transformation follows from the algebraic properties of enumerator polynomial. This one, which is a consequence of double evenness, we discussed that. You take y into iy, that's a consequence of double evenness. And that ensures that your theta function is nicely changing under this one. And a change under tau into minus one over tau guarantees by Mike Williams identity, which is this guy, another algebraic identity. So you reduced a rather complicated question of modular covariance of your theta series to some algebraic identities at the level of a numerator polynomial. That's the beauty of lattices associated with codes. I'm running out of time, which is not surprising because I started explaining things in great detail. I have some examples about even self-dual lattices. Maybe I'll skip that. I mean, maybe I'll skip that. If someone is interested, I can send this presentation, you can read through. All of that is written in a great detail in a pedagogical manner in our paper. Our paper is super long. It's like 99 pages literally, because most of it is written in a very pedagogical manner, such that if you have no background, you can just start reading and hopefully you'll understand everything without a problem. Okay.
Maybe, can I just ask one question at this point?
Absolutely, yeah.
So if I have a, is the other direction known? So if I have a general even self-dual lattice, can I always find some code? Okay.
No. Sorry, yes. Good question, perfect question. It's answered in this slide. For small dimensions, there is one-to-one correspondence. For n equal 8, there is a non-trivial theorem that for code or lattice to be even self-dual, dimension has to be divisible by 8.
For n equal
8, you have one-to-one correspondence, which is perfect. For n equal 16, you still have one-to-one correspondence between codes and lattices. Also, you have less correspondence between polynomials and lattices. You also have this relation between, is it true? Well, a famous story. Can you hear a shape of a drum? Is it true that theta function, theta series uniquely characterizes my lattice? The analog for the code, is it true that a numerator polynomial uniquely characterizes my code? The answer is no, that's the answer. Here at n equals 16, you have famous Milner's example of isospectral lattices, which are not isomorphic, which means that you have two codes which have the same enumerator polynomial, but those codes are distinct codes. So things are manageable here, but already interesting. For n equal 24, you have different number of lattices and codes, so there is no way back.
I see, thank you, yeah.
At least not any canonical way which would be discussed in books as something given. Of course, in 24 dimensions, everything is known, so there are many maps and you can design an assignment of 24 lattices to 9 codes, if you wish. But there is no canonical way, map to the extent I can tell you. Good. I skipped any connection to CFT because I assume that as soon as you saw even self-dual lattice, you already knew how to connect that to CFT, which is probably a little bit cavalier, but the partition function is basically a theta series of even self-dual lattice divided by Dedekind eta function to the power n. So that's the CFT partition function, where CFT is defined with help of even self-dual lattice lambda. I hope that makes sense to at least part of the audience. Unfortunately, I will not be able to explain that for the sake of time. Let me start with quantum codes. Now, with quantum codes, one issue is that they do not look like classical codes to begin with. And I want to explain what quantum codes are, and maybe I'll spend another 10 minutes explaining that. Because if we understand this, we understand the relation to classical codes, and then things will become more or less obvious. So I will be discussing stabilizer codes, but I'll start with this stupid situation when I already built a perfect fault-tolerant noiseless quantum computer, which operates on k physical qubits, which are also my k logical qubits, because there is no noise and no need for error correction. And for the sake of an argument, I combine those k qubits with n minus k auxiliary qubits, which are located in a completely different lab, and therefore there is a tensor product structure between logical psi L is psi logical, which is the state of a quantum computer, and n minus k auxiliary qubits, which are actually not very well isolated. They're put in the microwave. Okay, so if you start operating on your logical state, you'll have some non-trivial operations, and perhaps you will turn your psi L into psi L prime. You did some non-trivial quantum computing calculation, whatever, with the unitary transformation, whatever you wanted to do, you did. And while you were doing that, your auxiliary qubits got heated, and instead of zeros, they are now zeros and ones at random. You're displeased. In practice, you can forget about microwave because it's located miles away from a quantum computer. You can just continue working with your quantum computer. But for the sake of an argument, you can say, I want to return back to the state of this form because I want to correct for a quantum error. Okay, I want to return back to the state of this form. Obviously, states of this form, we would call them code subspace. So if you want to do that, that's not difficult to do. You measure states of these spins by Pauli matrices acting on the spins. This Pauli matrices commute. This is a syndrome measurement. You can do them in sequence from n minus k plus 1 to n. You measure all of them. And if so happens that some of those spins are not in the position 0, well, I'm interchangeably using the word spin and binary 0 and 1. 0 is up and 1 is down, okay? So if you see that your qubits, not all of them are in a position up, not a big deal. You know which ones are not in the position up, and you use sigma x, which will be your recovery channel, and you simply flip those spins which are not up. In this way, you will start with this state and you will return back to this form. You correct it for your quantum error. That was extremely simple. Okay, good. This is perfect, but for that simple thing, you actually need an ideal quantum computer, which defies the purpose. Now, in reality, the situation looks exactly like here, but with one important difference. This structure, which is here, is not a structure in the physical Hilbert space. This division between k logical qubits and auxiliary qubits, this division exists, but it doesn't exist in the computational basis of your physical qubits. It exists in some different logical basis, which means that you want to preserve the structure upon a unitary transformation. So you say that you have a state of your quantum system. It's a system of n spins. This is your physical wave function. And you want to define n minus k commuting syndrome measurements by taking Pauli matrices from the example before, from taking these Pauli matrices and doing large unitary transformation. So you assume that there is a unitary transformation, and if you apply this unitary transformation to the computational basis, you will recover this logical setup with k qubits being first, with k logical qubits being first, k qubits, and everything else being auxiliary qubits which absorb the noise. So you assume that, you don't have to prove this is the case, you can assume that. You basically define n minus k commuting operators by this formula. You also define, if necessary, n minus k recovery channel operators. And then you notice that by construction, those G operators commute. Therefore, they form an abelian group, which is called the stabilizer group. They form an abelian group. And the code subspace, which is, of course, all states of this form upon unitary transformation, the code subspace can be defined as the space invariant under the action of this group. So this group stabilizes the code subspace. That's why this group conventionally is called the stabilizer group, and the codes associated with this construction are called stabilizer codes. Now, I assume that most people present in the audience are familiar with the stabilizer codes, and at this point, you should immediately recognize the structure. your GIGJ are generators of the stabilizer group. This is your definition of the code subspace, and that's it. The only difference between what I introduced in the conventional story, any questions, by the way, about this? I just want to make a connection, very precise connection, with hopefully the knowledge you have about stabilized codes. Everything is clear? Okay, then I put the only difference between what I described so far and what people do in connection with real quantum computing is that in reality, measuring some abstract, highly entangled, very complicated operator GI would be impossible. To be able to measure GI in reality, you want this to be a relatively simple operator at the level of quantum circuit. In other words, we postulate, we restrict our attention. We postulate in a sense of we restrict our attention for operators GI, which are products of Pauli matrices on each spin. When I say a Pauli matrix, I mean that it could be trivial Pauli matrix identity, or it could be one of the three Pauli matrices. So you basically say that at most you can do, you can calculate, you can measure Pauli matrix on each spin independently. That's what you can do. And this measurement would be your stabilizer element measurement. Okay, with this restriction, it basically means that you choose your stabilizer generators to be of this form. You have an overall numerical coefficient, which is not terribly important. It is here just to make sure that GI squared is identity operator. And then you have four Pauli matrices. One, which is sigma x to the power zero, sigma z to the power zero. Sigma x, which is sigma x to the power one, sigma z to the power zero. And then two other options. And then, well, two other options. And finally, sigma y is sigma x to the power one, sigma z to the power one. Okay, so you have four options and I exhaust all four options by writing my stabilizer generator in this form. It's a product of x Pauli matrices and a product of z Pauli matrices. And each stabilizer generator is parameterized by two binary vectors, alpha and beta. And they're binary vectors because elements of alpha and beta are either zero or one. And therefore I have 4 to the n possibilities to have a, I have four vectors alpha and beta, vectors of alpha and beta, they describe 4 to the n possibilities of operators of this form. I hope this is clear. Now, another simple calculation shows that if you have G, which is parameterized by alpha 1 and beta 1, and you multiply it by G multiplied by, parameterized by alpha 2 and beta 2, then this is equal up to a scalar, which I don't care about. I don't care about because it's physically unimportant. It will be a generator parameterized by alpha 1 plus alpha 2, beta 1 plus beta 2, where this plus should be understood mod 2. So all this algebra should be understood as binary algebra over GF2 if you wish to be mathematical. So this structure is called projective representation. And basically what I arrive here is the following statement. I will skip the word projective because it's not important. What I basically established is that abelian stabilizer group is isomorphic up to this projection issue, which is unimportant. Abelian stabilizer group is isomorphic to the group of vectors, binary vectors alpha and beta, which are understood as vectors in a discrete vector space over algebra over field GF2. Vectors alpha and beta, they can be understood as code words of length 2n. So basically, stabilizer group can be encoded or rewritten identically as some classical linear binary code. So let me say that. Stabilizer group is some linear binary code of length 2n. Okay? This is good. This is already a very precise connection because between quantum codes and linear classical codes. But unfortunately, I did not take into account a very important part of the stabilizer story. It's not enough to have J squared equal to one. We also need to impose commutativity between Gi and Jj. If we impose that, there will be additional constraint, alpha I beta j plus alpha j beta I should be mod 2 should be equal to 0. Mod 2 should be equal to 0. This is an additional condition. So in fact, I should write this all together. Stabilizer group is a linear binary code of length 2n, which also satisfies this condition, and this condition called self-orthogonality. So this is a mathematical statement which is now precise. Quantum code, quantum stabilizer code, from the mathematical point of view, can be seen as a linear binary code with some additional self-orthogonality condition. Instead of seeing that as a linear code, is a linear binary code, there is also a way to see it as a linear code over another field, Galois field 4, with also self-orthogonality condition. I will not explain that, but this is explained in the literature and this is explained in our paper. And basically, that's it. We reformulated quantum codes as some linear codes with additional constraints. Okay, good. What are those initial additional constraints? You can easily see that alpha I beta j plus alpha j beta I is simply a scalar product with this metric, right? So basically, if I remember the, I've written here a linear binary code, it's essentially a repetition of what I have written here. Quantum stabilizer code is a binary vector space which is self-orthogonal with respect to this metric. Okay, and binary vector space is essentially the same as linear binary code. Now, if I remember the beginning of my talk that linear codes can be mapped to a lattice, I will realize that it will have a lattice and vectors in this lattice will have nice properties with respect to this metric. Now, it only takes a second to recognize that this metric is a Minkowskian metric. I can rotate it by a trivial transformation. I can rotate it to be plus, 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 minus, minus, minus. And therefore, I arrive at the most important statement, which is as follows. If I have a quantum code, which is a stabilizer code, I'll get a lattice in the Minkowskian space. And if my code is self-dual, and we can discuss what the self-dual quantum code is, on the quantum level, it means that the number of logical qubits is equal to zero. From the mathematical point of view, it means that this binary space will be self-orthogonal, self-dual, not self-orthogonal, will be self-dual. Then I will end up with lattice, which is self-dual with respect to this Minkowskian metric. And then if you impose additional constraint that your code is real, and the reality of a code means that this stabilizer matrix as a matrix is real valued. It has no imaginary eyes. If you also impose this constraint that your stabilizer code generators are real matrices, then you can easily show that your lattice will be even. And here we arrive at the most important statement that if you consider self-dual quantum stabilizer codes, which are real, I'm repeating myself. You consider real self-dual stabilizer codes, then you can easily map them to even self-dual lattices in Minkowski space. That's crucial in Minkowski space. And of course, with help of those lattices, we immediately define Narayan CFDs. Okay, so this is a very natural, and I would even say elegant generalization of the classical codes slash chiral CFD story. Now my codes are quantum and my CFTs are not classical, but my CFTs are not chiral, but Narayan. The rest is very similar to the classical story. I can define a numerator. It now depends on more variables. There are properties related to self-duality, McWilliams identity. There are properties related to reality of the code. And of course, this would be responsible to invariance or covariance of the Siegel theta function. Narayan CFTs, CFTs in Minkowski space, they can be associated Siegel theta function. And of course, Narayan's CPT partition function is a Siegel theta function divided by Dedekind function to certain power. And of course, like in the classical case, reality of a code at the algebraic level will be related to this transformation of the modular invariance into this transformation of the modular parameter. McWilliams identity will be responsible for invariance into this transformation of the modular parameter of the CFT partition function, which can be calculated like that. This is the Siegel theta function of your Narayan lattice. Okay, I think it was quick, but it is so similar to the classical case that there is, I mean, if we don't go into details, there is really no difference here. Okay.
I have a question. Yeah, so the K being equal to zero seems a bit problematic with a view towards applying this to holography, meaning that there would be no bulk degrees of freedom.
You immediately jump to a conclusion that the corresponding quantum error correcting code would be the one responsible for holography, right?
That's where I thought you were getting to.
Not in today's talk.
Okay.
That's certainly a line of thought which we pursue. As you pointed out, it's not as simple. It doesn't work like that. If you have self-dual code, it means that the code subspace is one-dimensional. Right. 2 to 0 is one. You have unique code subspace. It is what is called quantum error detection code. What I'm saying is not a statement which I am putting forward. This is like a hypothesis. I would rather associate this code subspace with the CFT vacuum. I'm currently working. I have some somewhat concrete proposal how things are supposed to work. We're currently working on this. Holography will play a role in this, but this is work in progress, and I will not be able to speak about that today.
Okay. Does this have anything to do with the fact that the tentative dual might be not a genuine gravitational theory, but a topological theory that's like Chern-Simons
Yes, my current understanding is yes.
Okay, again, so you just have like boundary degrees of freedom. Yeah,
you have some very finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. That's
right.
What you have in this case.
Right.
And now this is the answer. I know the answer. I'm saying currently my understanding is this.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for the great question, because it's an important question. But before we get this conclusion, I don't really have time. I think I exhausted my hour. Let me just tell you, there is other parts of beautiful math. Quantum codes, stabilizer codes are related, and I'm mostly appealing now to the quantum information part of the audience. They're related to what is called graph states. And there is a way to parameterize those stabilizer codes with graphs. That's a very known story. We rediscover those graphs through a stream, because if you have Narayan CFT, it's actually a very simple Narayan CFT. It's a compactification on a cube, and that's now appealing to the other parts of the audience. And since it's a very simple CFT compactification on a cube, everything is parameterized by the B field. You have T duality, which on the CFT, which on the code language becomes equal to the code equivalences. And then basically, the B matrix is anti-symmetric, but you can make it symmetric and it will be an adjacent symmetrics of a graph. So you can see this graph states very clearly on a CFT side. There is big chapter in our paper where we discuss all that in detail, and we discuss the relation at the level of graphs, which T-duality imposes. And I have some slides here about graph states and codes and how T-duality acts and what it means at the level of graphs. I'm skipping all of that. This is a beautiful, mathematically rigorous, and largely understood part of the story, which was known on the code side for about 15, 20 years. We just had to recognize interesting in our paper. I hope we have most of the answers. And by the way, this graph story is the way how you should parameterize classes of two dual equivalent codes. That's the right, that mathematically, at least the best way I know how to parameterize those classes of two dual codes. Okay, how much time I have or do not have?
I think we started late, so you can have another 5 minutes and we have time after the talk as well.
Okay, 5 minutes. I have three slides to tell you about applications. Basically, the main conclusion is already there. We established connection between quantum codes and CFTs. Now we want to get some mileage. Relation to holography would be a big prize. We start with a small prize. We have some nice examples of beautiful lattices and beautiful CFTs. This is, of course, akin to the story with chiral case, where you have, like, let's say, lattice E8, and you have chiral CFT E8. In this case, we start with the lattice E8, and we recognize that this lattice is also even self-dual Lorentzian lattice. And therefore, you can define, this is a somewhat non-trivial statement, certainly not the one which is, well, probably it was known to some people, but we did not see any mention of that in the literature, that E8 lattice is even self-dual in the Lorentzian sense. You can define Narayan CFT with help of that lattice, and surprise, surprise, it happens to be a very well-known SO8 level 1 Vezumina-Witten theory. And I think this connection between SO8 Vezumina-Witten theory and E8 lattice was not known. I think it was known that you can write it as a Narayan CFT, but it was not appreciated that the corresponding Narayan lattice is E8. So I think this is nice because Vezumina-Witten at level SO8 level 1 has been around for pretty much all my life, meaning since my early childhood. So I think it's sort of nice that you can still add something to this story. There are other beautiful lattices appearing in our story. There is no connection to Leech lattice, but there is certain connection to odd Leech lattice in 24 dimensions, which means that n equal 12. It's R12 comma 12. Okay, I'm skipping that because I didn't even think I will have time, so I don't even have slide to talk about that. But if you're into lattices and special CFTs, you might enjoy reading through and seeing what kind of connection we found. We do not fully understand the story there in the sense that we established a connection, but there's perhaps better mathematically more correct, more important way to say it. Second application, the important thing is that we reduce modular invariance of CFT partition function to some algebraic, at the level of algebraic and identity at the level of a polynomial. This polynomial may or may not be related to a real code. If you have a polynomial which satisfies certain algebraic identities, then you're guaranteed to have modular invariant function, which would be your would-be CFT partition function. And if you start looking algebraically using Mathematica, using some linear programming, already for n equal 3, you have polynomials W, and this is an exhaustive list for n equal 3. There are 6 polynomials which satisfy algebraic identities you want. It has non-negative coefficients, so blah, blah, blah. And therefore, you can take this W, plug them into this formula, and you will obtain modular invariant Z, which have all the properties of CFT partition function, certainly modular invariant, certainly coefficients of Q bar expansion is non-negative integer numbers, but we do not know any CFT for which this really would be a CFT partition function. And as you go into larger n, the number of these fake CFT partition functions grows extremely rapidly, and you can have tens of thousands of examples. Since you have so many examples, I suspect, we conjecture, that these would be CFT partition functions are not associated with any CFT at all. So from the point of bootstrap, we generated plenty of solutions of modular bootstrap, which we conjecture are not genuine CFTs. That's interesting because, of course, you always knew that solving modular bootstrap doesn't guarantee that you have a CFT. But it was always the case that whenever you solved modular bootstrap constraint, you had a genuine CFT. Now I solve modular bootstrap constraint, and here we go, there is perhaps no CFT. And I have not one, but thousands of examples, and I think that's interesting. Okay, similarly to this famous Milner example, we found examples of different Narayan CFTs which have exactly the same spectrum. These are genuinely different theories as CFTs. They have different OP coefficients, but their spectrum is the same. For n equals 7, we have a unique pair of theories. For n equals 8, we have 60 pairs and we have 5 triplets. And for n equals 11, we have groups of 11. I don't know if it's coincidence or not, 11 here, 11 here. I'm just trying to tell you that you can have groups of many theories, 11 different theories. All 11 of them are different. All 11 of them have exactly the same spectrum. Now, if I ask you if it's possible, probably you'll tell me maybe possible, but probably very difficult to construct. It's probably impossible, but improbable. But now I'm giving you many, many examples of isospectral CFTs, which means that isospectral theories are not that rare. Again, these are solutions of modular bootstrap. If you solve modular bootstrap and you hope this is a unique CFT, it might not be true. It might be more than one theory hiding behind the same point on your exclusion plot when I'm appealing to this bootstrap exclusion plots. Okay, I'm finishing. The idea of reducing modular bootstrap constraints to the level of algebraic relations of these polynomials, we call this idea baby bootstrap. At the level of codes, that of course would be conventional linear programming bounds for the code enumerator polynomials. And then in the paper which we posted in early September, we were trying to use this baby bootstrap approach to say something about behavior of spectral gap in Narayan theories. We didn't say much besides that there is certain similarity between the problems, and there is certain similarity even between how answers behave. So this is like baby bootstrap, and this is like actual bootstrap, at least for small n. So there is certain similarity. Right now we are working on a paper where we try to put forward this idea a little bit more, and at the level of a conjecture, we will use results derived on the code side to make a conjecture about asymptotic behavior of spectral gap in Narayan CFTs. And finally, there is this very interesting relation between averaged ensemble over all Narayan theories, averaging over all Narayan theories, and holographic description. It's called Chern-Simons gravity or exotic gravity or U1 gravity. This is essentially Chern-Simons theory in the bulk, but you need to sum over all handle-body geometries. I'm referring to this recent papers by Nimar Afkami Jedi and collaborators, as well as Maloney and Witten. I think you are familiar with these papers, at least at the level of the message. Now, when we were writing these papers over summer, we were thinking about this. We said, okay, look, they have an ensemble averaging over all Narayan CFTs. We have a very natural ensemble averaging over all codes. And it's actually mathematically a very well-known tool. Well, when you average over all lattices of a particular class, or you average over all codes of a particular class. If you do averaging over all codes, then properly defined spectral gap, I don't have time to discuss what it means properly defined. Properly means physically defined. It's not the smallest dimension. It's like where you expect a transition from sparse behavior to some holographic behavior. Then this value of the spectral gap grows linearly with the central charge. So you expect holographic description. And indeed, in the paper we published 3 months ago, we speculated at some technical level. We did not derive the action in the bulk, but we speculated that this action, that action in the bulk might exist at least in the chiral case, and by continuity of the argument in the non-chiral case as well. So basically we put forward the idea that an ensemble averaging over codes will have certain holographic description as well. We are working on this idea now. We are trying to in an upcoming paper, we are trying to provide a more concrete holographic description for this averaging over theories. From the technical point of view, this ensemble averaging over theories, excuse me, this ensemble of averaging over code theories, an ensemble averaging not all theories, but theories associated with quantum codes, is much simpler technically. It's a discrete set. You don't need to integrate. You just need to do a finite sum for any given n. So I think it gives you technical advantages. Similarly to the idea of baby bootstrap, by the way. So you basically reduce the complexity of the problem. Okay, maybe I was fast discussing last two slides, but my time is up. So let me try to conclude. The most important conclusion is here. We extended the known relation between codes, lattices, and CFTs to include quantum codes, lattices in Lorentzian space, and non-chiral CFTs. We immediately applied that to solve and understand something about modular bootstrap. We had many interesting examples of isospectral theories, fake CFT partition functions, which probably not associated with any CFT, and so on and so forth. And we have big questions. One big question is to understand asymptotic behavior of spectral gap in Narayan theories. And I don't think we will be able to say anything at the mathematical level of mathematical certainty, but we have a good conjecture using codes what this behavior might be. Another direction we are pursuing right now is to use this averaging over codes to describe holography, because we think this ensemble, that is an ensemble of CFTs, and I think this ensemble will help holographic interpretation. And of course, an important direction, which we also pursue, is to understand the role of this quantum regression codes at the level of CFT Hilbert space. And once we understand that, I think while understanding that, we will also better understand the role of holography. I don't think we will be able to trace our codes to the holographic error correction codes, simply because the holographic description is not the conventional one. It has topological theory, but I think that will be a toy example where we hopefully are able to understand all parts of the story quite well. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anatoly, for a great talk. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you should go ahead, sorry.
I can wait. I'll wait. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have perhaps you already said this, but I'm interested in this connection you were saying about the bootstrap. So as far as I understood, in this modular bootstrap approach, right, people believe that there are two necessary and sufficient conditions to, like, this modular invariance of the torus one-point function and associativity, whose solutions in principle are supposed to be, you know, like, determine, you know, like, partition functions for CFTs. And now with this connection to quantum codes, you're basically saying that perhaps those conditions are necessary but not sufficient. And I was wondering if you have any proposal of, like, what an additional condition would be in this case, which would kind of, like, pin down just based from this intuition about quantum codes.
Okay, look, I had bad connection. So I missed a big part of your question. I understood the beginning.
Yeah. So basically, I'm just wondering whether this connection to quantum codes. So you are saying that the bootstrap constraints people use right now are perhaps necessary conditions, but not sufficient, because they may produce fake solutions.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering whether the connection to these quantum codes would suggest how we would supplement these two conditions if there is an additional constraint from the
this
point
is
of
a great this is a great question this is a great question I think I hope we comment on that in the paper, maybe in the conclusion section. I hope the connection will be in the opposite way. So speaking of codes, we call them fake polynomials. I don't know how mathematicians call them. It doesn't look like they call them anything. But of course, they're very well aware that you can have polynomials which satisfy all the algebraic constraints, but not associated with any codes. They have their own language to think about it. They have their what we call baby bootstrap. They know all too well this is a linear programming bounds on codes or lattices, and they know that very, very well. And they have the following question quite often. Is it possible, they obtain linear programming bounds constraints, and they want to know if those constraints are tight. The best possible code with a given n, they call the optimal code. But if the optimal code also saturates the linear bound constraint, they call it extremal code. They do not know, and they say this is an open problem, if in certain dimension like 72, if there are extremal codes, meaning if the best possible code satisfies, saturates the linear programming bound. From the from our point of view, our conversation point of view, that means the following. They generated, or they can generate, fake polynomials. They generate invariant polynomials, but they do not know if those polynomials are fake or not. If they can for sure say that those polynomials are fake, they would say there are no extremal codes. If they know that those polynomials, at least one of them, is genuine, they would say there is for sure an extremal code, and the problem will be solved. So mathematicians want to know that. This is one of the classic questions which they discuss in the books. But there is no easy way. I asked some people which I believe are biggest experts, and they told me, no, we don't have any elegant way except for maybe brute force search and stuff like that. Now, what I hope is that CFTs are much richer objects, right, than codes. So if you have a map from codes to CFTs, it actually means that at the level of CFTs, you might satisfy a lot more constraints. The constraints I have been thinking about is modular invariance on a genus two partition function. I do not know if, well, that is certainly for a CFT as a sufficient condition, so I can write it down as an additional condition. I do not know, though, if I write it down as an additional necessary condition, if I will be able to translate it back at the code level in any meaningful way. It might be that if I translate it back, it will be at the level of, okay, you basically need to construct the code, and if you manage to construct the code, you satisfy this additional conditions, and that's all. Then there is no mileage. But that hasn't been done, and I think this is an interesting problem to just look into. And if you want to be optimistic, you can say CFTs will actually guide us toward understanding codes better, which would be an amazing situation because this is an open problem in discrete maths. So if you are interested, I will be more than happy to discuss that in more detail over email, over Skype, because I started looking into that, but we didn't make any progress. We were working on this other things I mentioned today.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's super interesting. Thanks so much.
Yeah, maybe on what you just said. So I thought, or it at least seemed like from the way you presented in your talk, that the logical progression was start with a quantum code, you know, you construct an even self-dual Lorentzian lattice, and then you arrive at some Narayan CFT. So, but can any of those arrows be inverted? Like, how would I imagine using either like classification knowledge of Lorentzian lattices or Narayan CFTs to construct new quantum codes?
Well, if you speak, you want more broad. You're not worried about the polynomials. You just want to be more broad. So if you ask what is the mileage for the codes from CFTs, what we did in our paper is that we know the moduli space of Narayan lattices. It's very, very simple, right? You act by On, N boosts, and you produce all Narayan lattices. We actually use that to construct the space of all quantum codes, these self-dual real ones, as a group coset. To the extent we know, this representation hasn't been known in the literature on codes. I cannot tell you that mathematicians immediately got excited, maybe because we didn't emphasize that and because our paper is 99 pages long and it's buried somewhere in the middle. So I assume that very few people actually found it. But this is a result with the flavor of what you ask. We used something we know from sort of physics, and we found this new mathematical cassette description of quantum codes. I think you can do more. We speculate that this Cassett construction may be used to more efficiently average over codes, which is a usual business in this code story, but we actually did not develop this technique. We did not use this group structure to average more efficiently. So maybe this is something which can be done. Yeah, I should mention that I think the construction we have is not the unique one. I actually think there will be many similar constructions where you match codes of different kind to different CFTs. And of course, that's also very interesting to understand.
Thank you. Yeah.
Is there any way in which the extensions you might be talking about can be applied to like K greater than zero? Is there
K greater than zero?
Yeah.
What is K?
Got it.
Well, at the level of lattices, we gave the relation between codes and lattices for any K. It just those lattices are not self-dual. They're are integer or even, but they're which means that they're self-orthogonal as lattices, but they're well, not self-orthogonal, integer, but they're not self-dual. Does it immediately make a revolution in quantum computing? It doesn't, probably doesn't. But like if you read any textbook on quantum computing, they give you an example of one of the first codes, a Steen code. It's a 7,1,3 quantum code. And mathematically, we explain that this Steen code it's an example of what is called CSS code. It's actually at the level of lattices, a sum of lattice is 7 and I think it's dual or something like that. So it's a direct product of two very well-known lattices. It doesn't immediately make any revolution for quantum computing, but I think that's a language which some of us can appreciate because we know what E7 lattice is and we can think about it in some good ways. Maybe more general, I would say that this way of relating codes to lattices might help you design new codes. Certainly the relation to graphs helps you design new codes, that's for sure. And maybe a relation to lattices and to CFTs might also help you design new codes because the better code is, morally speaking, the larger spectral gap in your CFT is. So the problem of constructing large spectral gap is basically the problem of finding good quantum code. So as an offshoot of this project, I'm actually trying to find large spectral gap CFTs, and at the same time, I'm trying to find quantum codes for, let's say, 20 qubits, which would have large Hamming distance. These are very similar problems. So I think this relation helps, but I cannot give you any universal tool. Basically, I cannot say, oh, look, this connection with CFTs immediately solves an outstanding problem. That I cannot say. Did I answer your question?
I was actually more curious about the connection to CFTs and if it's possible to associate codes with K greater than zero to if there is some way to do that, make that work.
I understand. Yeah. I understand where you're at. You actually want to see a non-trivial code subspace.
Yeah.
I do not know if that's physically, again, we need to understand the role of this code in the Hilbert space of a CFT. But if what I said is morally correct, that code subspace is basically ground state, then for K larger than zero, you need to have degenerate ground state. Again, I'm not insisting that I'm correct. This is a wild guess, but it also shows that you need some, well, that's what people do in spin chains, right? They have like very artificial spin chains with very degenerate ground state, which is a code subspace for some quantum error correcting code. There are recent works like that. I think there is a work by Fernando Brandao and collaborators. There is another work by Ramis Mavis with collaborators, or I don't recall other author, co-authors, sorry about that. So there are works like that. I think there is moral connection to our story. I am thinking if it can be made precise, but I'm not there yet just to say, oh, this is completely different, or this is exactly the same.
Okay.
I think this is an interesting question to think about.
Okay, I actually have just one quick question from the quantum computing side as well. So if oftentimes when I'm thinking about codes, I want to find codes with like a special symmetry or something, which means they have a logical gate, which is transversal and can do some, let's say, non-Clifford thing. And then, but you can sort of relate these to conditions on the kind of binary matrices you use to build the codes. And I wonder what these kind of things would have, if they would have some relation in the CFTs.
You're talking about, can we formulate your question, what you want to do with the code? Can we formulate it at the level of automorphism group? Local Clifford group. So if you want to specify something about local Clifford group, mm-hmm. it depends what you want to specify, but local Clifford, like Clifford group becomes t-duality.
Yeah.
So basically you are saying that you're sitting in the model point in the moduli space, which has certain nice properties and t-duality. The t-duality is extended to some, to include some automorphisms. Then of course you can try to find this point. Mm-hmm. On a CFT side as well, yeah.
Interesting.
And that hasn't been explored, but it's a common thing that if your automorphism is extended, is enhanced on a CFT side, it means that you have non-abelian symmetries, and in the bulk you will have non-abelian fields. So it's an interesting story. It's an interesting story to think about, but nobody tried yet. So it's hasn't been touched.
Great, thank you. Okay, so unless there's any more questions, let's thank Anatoly again for a great talk.
And I got another question.
Oh, sorry, John, go ahead.
Nice talk. could you say a bit more about this, what was it, this edge local complementation and t-duality? What exactly was the connection to t-duality there?
Good. Let me just ask, are you familiar with this graph?
Yeah.
Graph code story. So then you know that there is local Clifford group which mm-hmm. acts on the code, and at right. the level of graphs there is equivalence on graphs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this equivalence on graphs acts as local complementation or edge local complementation. This is an operation on a graph which turns it into another graph.
Right.
And then you can have a whole orbit of graphs equivalent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now. On the CFT side, you can parameterize your CFTs by metric and B-field. Metric can be chosen to be identity. B-field is an anti-symmetric matrix. It's an adjacent symmetrix of a graph.
Anti-symmetric or symmetric?
It's anti-symmetric, but anti-symmetric matrix has as much information as a symmetric one because on the diagonal you have zeros.
Ah, okay, good.
Okay, so it's a mathematic, we discussed those questions. We didn't overlook them. Now, you want to ask what is this graph equivalent story or code equivalent story on a CFT side? That's just an action of t-duality. So apparently t-duality acts exactly like code automorphism, and it changes the graphs from one to another using this operation of edge local complementation.
Oh, is it t-duality because you're compactifying on tori?
Yes, you compactified on a cube. Your torus is a cube. You have b-field, but you can still do t-duality, and that will change the b-field. If you interpret b-field as an adjacent symmetrix of a graph, that induces the action on a graph. And we prove that it actually induces an action of a graph. And then we also show, using the known literature, that it's literally the same action as in the case of graph states. So this is this edge local complementation action.
Interesting.
Sorry,
continue.
No, I just wanted to say that a non-trivial interesting statement here is that what was Clifford symmetry, the Clifford group on a graph state becomes q-duality on a CFT side.
Interesting. So maybe one other comment. I've never seen this E8 showing up in SO8 level one before.
Yeah, so I think this is our original result. We are very proud of it.
That's really interesting. So I guess typically I think of E8 as describing being like the edge CFT lattice for like eight like chiral bosons or something.
Of course.
It's trivial topological order. There's no anions. Let's say I put it in a quantum Hall. So I'm not so clear on this distinction, this issue that you mentioned earlier in the talk about whether you have Chern-Simons or gravity. So maybe that's another question. That's
probably another question. But E8, conventionally E8 is a Euclidean lattice, and then it's a chiral theory. We are talking about non-chiral.
So you're making it Lorentzian somehow, and you have like an annulus. Is that how I should think of it? Like with four on each edge, or maybe just counter-propagating modes on.
Well, it just means that you're sitting a four-dimensional torus, but you have a four-dimensional cube. Uh-huh. But you have B field.
Oh, I see. And you can generalize this to higher than four. That's not a problem, right?
Well, I mean, we have examples for all n. This code CFT, you can take any n. But lattices, Narayan lattices, which will appear, will not be the lattices you recognize. E8 is one nice example, which you sort of saw before in a different context. But most lattices we construct are not anything you thought before. This is just some lattices with unclear symmetries and clear properties.
So you have a construction, but you need other constraints to be satisfied, or maybe.
No. We guarantee that there is a CFT. These Narayan lattices, they're not. We cannot say what is very special about. I mean, we can say some properties which are special, but there is. I cannot say, oh, they're related to these exceptional groups, or they're related to AN root lattices, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so if you start with lattices that are not unimodular, where does everything break, or where does it get hard? I guess is what I want to know. That wasn't really clear to me, and maybe it's not clear. To you.
If the lattice is not unimodular, you will not be able to formulate a CFT because it will not be modular invariant. You will have some problem at the level of vertex separator algebra, consistency of vertex separator algebra, I suppose.
I mean, you have some vector value modular form, though, is usually how people deal with that. And it's you have a whole bunch of fields that all transform amongst themselves.
So, yes, but it's
your paper in red, so maybe there's more you're doing.
No. It's we don't discuss that. I mean, if you have non-self dual lattice, then you will have certain modular properties, but not the ones necessary to produce modular invariant CFT partition function. Mm-hmm. It's not the question we discuss. It's the question sort of which was discussed, I think, in the 80s. What kind of lattice you need to have a consistent CFT.
Oh, sure.
So we just use that piece of knowledge if you wish. I don't think we are contributing to this in any way. But I think it's known that if your lattice is not self-dual, you will not be able to have consistent CFT.
Oh, I see. But it's at the level of full CFT is probably why this is trivial. Because you could take any lattice, like a chiral CFT, that's not a problem. So is that
well, with chiral CFT, we also need even self-dual lattice. Otherwise, you will not have modular invariants. You need to have an even lattice for the OP operators to be able to for single valuedness of OP expansion, and modular invariants under tau goes into minus one over tau. Is necessary, it requires the lattice to be self-dual. I'm not adding anything new to this to on top of what is discussed in Polchinski. I'm just trying to say well-known thing, I think it's a well-known thing, that to have self-consistent conformal field theory, you need to have even self-dual lattice. And both properties are important. And
actually, just on that point, because this is something that came up in the beginning of the talk that I was a little confused about. So for each even self-dual lattice in 24 dimensions, I can obviously associate a VOA and construct a consistent CFT, right?
Yeah.
But I guess when you mentioned this connection to, there were only 9 of those, or maybe 15 that...
No, there are 24 such lattices.
Such lattices, but only 9 of them, right, like came up in your...
There are 9 which come from codes,
yeah,
where the construction I described in the talk. There are generalizations of this construction, and which we discuss in the paper, but I didn't touch in the talk. And famous Leech lattice is related to one of the codes via that construction. But in fact, that construction is quite powerful, and there is, I don't know that very well. I just read through some papers. I think this construction allows you to go, well, this construction is called twist in our paper. We discuss it in our paper. It's not difficult. It's like mathematically, it's very, very simple in general terms. It allows you to start with even self-dual lattice and produce perhaps another even self-dual lattice. So you can have a VAB. And in 24 dimensions, these lattices are all studied and people know how to go between them and so on and so forth.
Maybe my question, is there something interesting or about the 15 which don't admit obvious code constructions?
Well, the most interesting one is the Leech lattice, right? It gives rise to monster C. That's the most interesting one.
No. But the 15 that don't admit code realizations.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
The Leech lattice is not related to code in this simple way I described in my talk.
Yeah, I see.
The Leech lattice is one of those 15.
I see.
Maybe just a comment. We may be just talking about different things. So I mean, I'm okay. Thinking about, I have like U1 level K Chern-Simons theory.
Yeah.
They take the WZW theory on the boundary.
Yeah, but that would be a chiral theory, right? Yeah. That would be a chiral theory.
Right. Okay. What, so the difference.
What I described just in my talk, SO8 level 1, that's non-chiral.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well,
that's not chiral. It's not a chiral theory. It has...
Correct.
Yeah. It's a theory of 8 Majorana fermions, but it's not chiral. And it has O8 symmetry, which is... this SO8 is a subgroup of the full symmetry of the E8 lattice, but mm-hmm. we only have a subgroup because we also need to preserve a Minkowski metric. So we have 2 structures. We have E8 lattice and we have Minkowski metric, and we need to preserve both of them. And it's only SO8 subgroup which does that.
Right, and I think there's a sense in which you could write it down as like an abelian Chern-Simons theory, if I remember, where you write down like the K matrix is basically something like the SO8 root lattice, it's like a D4 root lattice or something.
I think you are asking how to describe this theory holographically.
Am I? I'm not exactly sure, but I'm not a holographer.
But you're asking how to describe it using Chern-Simons, right?
Yeah. Well, this is what I know. We're after the talk. We're just talking.
Yeah. So I think this is a good question. There are a lot of papers on the subject, but there is also quite a bit of confusion. So right now I'm trying to actually understand in this part of the story where I try to relate codes, quantum codes to Hilbert space, I'm actually trying to do that by introducing this Chern-Simons description. So mm-hmm. one thing I'm trying to sort through is this non-chiral Chern-Simons story and how to carefully make the relation between Chern-Simons and CFTs in this case. There are some subtleties because there are some degrees of freedom on the boundary, and I don't claim I fully understand the story.
So one other thing you might want to throw in your sales pitch for why this connection is so useful, right, is there was this recent paper, maybe last year, by Tom Hartman and folks, where they showed that there were some bootstrap bounds on the lowest essentially that could reproduce this kind of celebrated result in that shows that the E8 lattice is the densest sphere packing. This was proved like rigorously just a couple years ago by turned out that actually the year prior that a Psi student at PI put in bound.
Daniel Malzak.
Right. And so this was sort of I was very shocked to learn this connection that you had this outstanding result that like, you know, like Elkies and
Cohen,
I guess, like,
yeah,
solved this like linear program or linear program with infinite many variables. And so wouldn't it be nice if there was some analytic function and then boom, it just comes out of the bootstrap.
Yes, exactly.
That told me that this is like a very powerful connection.
This is certainly, we believe that what we have is a part of that story, because there is this famous connection between sphere packings and classical codes. Mm-hmm. And we think that we are having this more general connection when you have quantum codes related to Narayan lattices, but instead of sphere packing, you have full bootstrap problem. So of course we know this paper by Hartman very well, and the motivation to try to find CFTs with larger spectral gap is basically based on the idea that this is a problem related to sphere packing.
Right. Well, so maybe one more question on that note. So I think it seemed like one of the big innovations that they had was that they used a different, like they didn't assume this holomorphic factorization of the partition function. Oh, I may be losing you, but if you can hear me, I'll continue the question. Are you picking a similar, are you getting similar bounds for the same reason that they are? Like, are you using the same real structure on the torus? We'll see if maybe we lost you. Maybe you lost me.
No, I can hear you, John. I don't. Yeah, maybe we lost Tolia. Nope.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to answer? How's it going, by the way?
That's good. Yeah, how are you?
All right.
Oh, wait. It seems like, and I totally just reconnected though.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, very good.
My apologies. Lost connection. Sorry, I started answering and then I got connected, right?
Okay, I didn't hear any answer. I wasn't
sure. Tolia, we can barely hear you now.
Okay. Well, I just said that we are of course aware of this paper by Hartman. It was a part of the motivation why we started looking at the codes before the paper was published. But I think this is a part of the same story. There is known connection between codes and sphere packings. So I think now we just have a generalization when instead of sphere packing, you have the full bootstrap problem. And instead of classical codes, you have quantum codes.
Mm-hmm.
So we certainly know more recent papers by Hartman as well, where he used this connection to sphere packing to say something about spectral gap. That motivated us to look into maximal spectral gap in small n, to think about spectral gap asymptotically for infinite n. I didn't mention that, but of course, those papers are a part of the same big story, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, very interesting. I'll have to read your paper.
Yeah.
Nice talk.
All right.